100 personas las que se hicieron presentes a la concentración, con la esperanza de que el caso de estas 17 mujeres tenga la resolución que ellos esperan y en el tiempo más inmediato. Desde Radio La Clave, en San Salvador, El Salvador, informó Jacqueline Quintanilla.
El presidente de Nicaragua, Daniel Ortega, aseguró que su gobierno se esfuerza por garantizar la seguridad de los mineros. La semana pasada, 29 trabajadores quedaron atrapados en un accidente en una mina artesanal. 7 no han podido ser encontrados.
Los hermanos mineros decidieron suspender la búsqueda de los 7 hermanos que continúan desaparecidos. No podemos descartar que si las condiciones climáticas y el terreno lo permitieran, se puedan hacer nuevos intentos. Porque no se puede perder la fe, no se puede perder las esperanzas.
Fueron suspendidas las actividades de rescate de 8 mineros que quedaron soterrados la noche del jueves en la mina El Comal, ubicada en el municipio de Bonanza, en la región autónoma del Atlántico Norte, Raán, debido a los deslizamientos y la lluvia, así lo informó el gobierno nicaragüense. En esa mina el viernes fueron rescatados otros 20 mineros, sin embargo los 8 quedaron soterrados debido a las malas condiciones del lugar, y pese al trabajo de búsqueda de brigadas de rescate fue imposible localizarlos, así lo anunció a medios oficiales Rosario Murillo, vocera del gobierno. Esta tragedia no es la primera vez que ocurre. En lo que va del año, 6 personas han perdido la vida en condiciones similares, y de no tomarse las medidas de seguridad respectiva, la tragedia podría repetirse. Así lo advirtió Olivia Guevara, oficial de hidrocarburos del ambientalista Centro Humboldt, que a continuación escuchamos.
Esta gente diariamente se mete en túneles, diariamente están trabajando con mercurio. O sea, aquí van a haber, primero, una gran contaminación con mercurio, porque ahí entra el mercurio como que fuera agua helada, ¿verdad? Esto entra de forma inadecuada, sin guantes, luego lo procesan y lo calientan, ellos aspiran todos esos vapores, y muchas personas saben cuáles son los grandes riesgos y los grandes problemas que causan el mercurio.
En los pueblos mineros, la gente que está sin empleo se gana la vida arriesgándose en la búsqueda del oro de manera artesanal, exponiéndose a todo tipo de riesgo, desde el uso inadecuado del cianuro y el mercurio, causante de muchas enfermedades, así como introducirse en minas abandonadas y sin ninguna protección. El dirigente de la Central Sandinista de Trabajadores, Luis Barbosa, también se sumó a la advertencia de crear las condiciones de seguridad en la zona para evitar nuevas tragedias como estas. Información que compartimos desde Radio Universidad, en Managua, Nicaragua, Nelson Rodríguez.
Tiene que iniciarse una nueva etapa de la revolución bolivariana en todos los órdenes. En el orden ético, político, económico, una nueva etapa de la revolución.
En Venezuela, el presidente Nicolás Maduro anunció el comienzo de una nueva etapa de la revolución bolivariana, la misma que será dividida en 5 etapas de desarrollo para beneficiar al pueblo. La revolución económica, de la cultura, ciencia y tecnología, profundizar la revolución social a través de las misiones, la revolución política del Estado y la del socialismo territorial. Sobre la revolución del conocimiento científico, señaló Maduro que está vinculada a una nueva sociedad, la de valores y de ética. La revolución del Estado, dijo, tendrá como objetivo destruir los restos del Estado burgués y construir un Estado con poder político del pueblo. Víctor Juárez es catedrático de la Universidad Nacional Experimental de la Seguridad, con sede en Venezuela.
El principal mensaje que está enviando el presidente Maduro es un mensaje de confianza y de refrescamiento en una etapa nueva que está afrontando el proceso revolucionario. Recordemos que esto no es una nueva política del presidente Maduro, es la profundización de la visión estratégica de la gestión pública del presidente Chávez. Es importante que destaquemos esto y cómo va a permitir materializar el plan de la patria, que en materia de gestión pública exige un gobierno más eficiente. Entonces, el mensaje a la comunidad internacional es que el gobierno está al tanto y tiene la voluntad política al más alto nivel de impulsar y acelerar los cambios posibles para hacer un gobierno más eficiente a nivel interno y a nivel internacional. Es importante que destaquemos 3 elementos fundamentales. El primero de ellos es cómo aborda el presidente Maduro la creación y la necesidad de hacer una revolución del conocimiento. Eso indica su visión estratégica en el siglo XXI, donde se desarrolla la tecnología, el conocimiento para liberar, no para dominar, distinto a la visión tradicional que se ha permitido o que se ha promovido para el uso de la tecnología. Otro elemento importante que debemos destacar es el elemento central desde su discurso cuando promueve la creación y la profundización del Estado comunal, que va unido a la propuesta de un ecosocialismo. Recordemos que la propuesta del Plan de la Patria establece la salvación del planeta en un contexto, un cambio climático, donde las principales potencias tradicionales no quieren o no tienen la voluntad política de ejercer una acción efectiva para combatir el cambio climático. Y el tercer elemento que me parece interesante destacar en este análisis es el elemento de la formación de los funcionarios públicos. La formación, un sistema permanente de formación bajo una metodología científica rigurosa que fortalezca. Y es importante cuando nosotros vemos la voluntad política, en el caso del presidente Maduro, de continuar esa visión que tiene el presidente Chávez. Y recordemos cuando él estableció en distintos discursos la necesidad de refundar la patria, y es una necesidad que no se puede postergar, es impostergable. Es el entendimiento del momento político e ideológico que vive la revolución para profundizarla. Como decía el presidente Chávez en su momento, el hombre y sus circunstancias. La circunstancia es el tiempo histórico y es el ahora, y esto parte por una reestructuración de la administración pública a todos sus niveles. Recordemos que no es se puede centrar esta reformulación del Estado al más alto nivel. No, debemos promover, y eso es un llamado que se le hace desde este espacio a los distintos funcionarios públicos, a que hagan un proceso de autorreflexión y ver qué se puede hacer, qué se está haciendo mal y qué se puede proponer. Cuando evaluamos los cambios y los ajustes que hace el presidente Maduro en el área económica, podemos observar cómo claramente él visualiza y deja sobre el tapete, coloca sobre la mesa de debate, que aquí hay una verdadera lucha estructural. El trasfondo aquí es que se enfrentan dos modelos, dos visiones de país antagónicas, ¿no? La primera es una visión, ese modelo rentista del Estado burgués que se intentó implantar en la sociedad venezolana a principios del siglo XX, y el otro modelo es una economía socialista, es una economía, una nueva arquitectura económica. Lo que se está buscando ahorita con esta lucha al contrabando es reducir estas distorsiones que hay actualmente en la economía y lograr y profundizar desde el punto de vista económico, productivo, con esa visión estratégica que se planteó en el Plan de la Patria y que visualizó el presidente Chávez, en su momento, consolidar a la Venezuela potencia.
Era Víctor Juárez, catedrático de la Universidad Nacional Experimental de la Seguridad, con sede en Venezuela. El presidente Nicolás Maduro añadió que para fortalecer las políticas para dar poder al pueblo venezolano, se crearán nuevos consejos populares que tengan como objetivo reforzar las actividades y trabajo social en las comunidades. La nueva estructura consta de los consejos presidenciales populares de las comunas, de las mujeres, de los campesinos, para la cultura de los pueblos indígenas y de la juventud. En Los Ángeles, yo soy Fernando.
Nos vamos a noticias de Estados Unidos. Dos hombres afroamericanos con deficiencia mental que pasaron 30 años presos fueron liberados el miércoles luego de que exámenes de ADN mostraran su inocencia. En 1983 se les acusó de violar y matar a una niña de 11 años de edad. El juez de la Corte Superior en Carolina del Norte, Douglas Sasser, ordenó fueran liberados después de que se comprobara que un hombre con historial de asaltos sexuales es el responsable del delito. Pero hace 3 décadas no fue investigado por la policía, a pesar de vivir cerca de donde ocurrió el crimen. Henry McCollum, de 50 años de edad, que pasó 30 años en el pabellón de la muerte esperando ser ejecutado, fue recibido por su familia cuando salió de la prisión central de Raleigh en Carolina del Norte. Agradeció a Dios por su libertad y por mantenerlo fuerte. Dijo a la prensa que sabía algún día saldría de prisión y que no alberga resentimiento en su corazón. Su medio hermano, Leon Brown, de 46 años de edad, salió también de un instituto correccional en Greenbelt, donde purgaba cadena perpetua. Opositores a la pena de muerte aseguran que el sistema de justicia en Estados Unidos castiga con mayor frecuencia a afrodescendientes, latinos y pobres. El equipo del informativo Pacífica los invita a que nos sigan en Facebook, a través de Twitter en @info-pacífica, en el canal del informativo Pacífica en YouTube y en nuestro blog en pueblossinfronteras.wordpress.com.
Y eso es, entonces, Bathrobespierre's Broadsides. That's Bathrobespierre's Broadsides to you English and Spanish speakers alike, but this program is in English. You're tuned to the stream of Free Radio at freakradio.org. Thank you for listening in. Our apologies for not being on live on the air, which we won't be until we get a place. You can be helpful in that if you have ideas, suggestions, want to help look for a place for us. We need a place, essentially, we have a studio, we need a place to set up an antenna. And that can be any place with a second story or a large tree, a tall tree, or even not that tall a tree, but a tree that enables us to hook up to put an antenna up there and a small shed at the bottom of it. So get in touch with us at freakradio.org, and you can also, of course, check out schedules there. You can check out some archives. I'm not there much on this show if you're interested in Bathrobespierre's Broadsides, which will be running until 8 o'clock. And tonight we're going to be having a live phone interview and poetry reading by Julia Vinograd from Berkeley. She's a poet I particularly like and have had on the air before. I call her a poet of the streets, although she now lives indoors. Or actually, I don't know if she's ever actually had much time outside. She's older, she's disabled, but her mind, her heart, and her spirit are definitely not disabled. So that's at 6:30 if you want to tune in. And we're going to be covering a lot of interviews and updates from the last couple weeks. Tomorrow there is a All Faith Communities kind of get-together starting at 2 o'clock at the Red Church, Calvary Episcopal, running through the afternoon, concerning with problems of homelessness, so to speak. And HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, speakers are going to be there, trying to encourage folks to take the next steps necessary to defend homeless people and their rights, and to establish not just shelters, but simple housing is the phrase we came up with at our HUF meeting. Tip of the hat to Elise for that phrase. And you can check it out. We'll be meeting at 1 o'clock right before the 2 o'clock church shindig, which isn't, you don't have to be religious to come to this. It's about churches provide actually the largest shelter program. Well, there are 46 spaces in the Paul Lee Loft, which is a non-church program in the soon-to-be-locked and sealed and ID-checked Homeless Lack of Services Center. But churches don't require that kind of tattoos on the arm, so to speak, although, of course, the Homeless Lack of Services Center isn't technically requiring tattoos, but they are going to be requiring ID verification. Are going to be going through a locked security gate. Security for whom is a little unclear to me. Actually, it isn't very unclear. It's some people feel they get increased security through decreased homeless people in the area. That's their big theory, and I think that's what the Homeless Lack of Services Center is colluding with in that particular perspective, though there are some who say that it also helps them get grants, because if they can verify who they have there, they can get a better grip on government money, which isn't all bad. Some of the money does eventually trickle down to services for homeless people. What percentage of that money? That's a very good question. And I don't know that it's ever really been adequately answered or even researched out there at the 115 Coral Street address. Let's begin with a little of the standard intro to Bathrobespierre's Broadsides, and then hopefully your phone calls, 427-3772, area code 831,
427-3772. The whole world, no problem, for only one reason. The president raises the question, who wants a plan? The homeless, our problem, for only one reason.
genocide. Where is
home? And welcome to the September 4th, 2014 edition of Bathrobe Spears Broadsides. I'm Robert Norris. For those who are new, this is a show which talks about stuff around Santa Cruz City and County. And we also jump far afield, too, based upon my impulses and what I think has some relation to us here, and also, I guess, what interests me as well. Do try to kind of narrow in on civil rights for poor people, services denied or discrimination imposed on poor people, and, yeah, kind of like that. Again, your call-in number here, if you want to call in, is 427-3772. I invite people to do that. It's a greater show if we have a greater interaction and dialogue with other folks, and that's you out there. So, a couple of developments. The city's police department, Parks and Rec, and other bureaucracies in the city have been confronted recently with Public Records Act requests that I've been putting in around various issues, and I want to kind of give you an update on what's going on with that. Most recently, my concern, well, it came up yesterday particularly because at the Huff meeting, folks were sufficiently interested to actually want to go check the public records immediately after the meeting. We do a Huff meeting every Wednesday at 11 o'clock at the Sub Rosa Cafe, and you're invited if you'd want to come down. That's at 703 Pacific. We were interested in the issue of a proposed permit parking area around the Circles Church out at Arrett Circle, which is where California and Woodrow Streets intersect, where the Sunrise Cafe is, and that's a sort of a fancy name for a church program that runs three mornings a week from 4 in the morning to 9 or 9:30, and that is for coffee and a kind of a warming place, place to rest, a place to be have some company and some support. Churches are only allowed to have three vehicles if a person is actually sleeping in them overnight. That's in liberal Santa Cruz. And unfortunately, most of the churches aren't that liberal, and so there's less than a dozen churches that actually allow people to sleep in them. I don't even actually know the number right now, but there aren't that many. The Circles Church is one of them, and Pastor Steve, who's out there, has been getting a lot of flack from neighbors. I don't know that there's actually been a lot of justified flack in terms of actual problems that the neighbors that interfere with the neighbor's ability to go to work or be safe and comfortable in their homes. I think, and I may be wrong about this, and I'd be happy to be corrected, it has more to do with a desire that those kinds of people, poor people, not be in their neighborhood so close every night. And some of that involves people who park their vehicles in the parking area right adjacent to the church, which is off church property. You're still not allowed to sleep in a vehicle anywhere in Santa Cruz on any public property after 11 o'clock at night until 8:30 in the morning. So it's still illegal for a person to pull over and try to sleep there. You know, we don't want criminals infesting our neighborhoods with their snores, right? But it is also true that some people pull up early and wait there for the Sunrise Cafe to open at 4 so they can go in, have some coffee, sit down, talk with friends, exchange information, rest, actually get some sympathy and support. I haven't been out there during this Sunrise Cafe, but I know some Huff members are regular workers there. Pat Colby, for example, works there every Saturday morning. Hats off to you, Pat, for that. It's a positive thing. It was a particularly necessary thing in the winter when people were freezing to death in San Jose last winter. You may remember four people died of hypothermia. And in Santa Cruz, the government did absolutely nothing about this. They have an armory program, but it's only got 100 slots, and that's that. And then they have a homeless lack of services program, which provides 46 spots for people who are... You know,
It's a little unclear to me, but what I had heard in the past was you have to be on the waiting list for a couple of months to get on into that program. More recently, I've heard from a local, from an employee that actually there's spots that can, you can actually get there on the night. I'd like to get some more information. So if anybody who is outside or houseless or has used that program recently has experience walking in on the night and getting into the program just to sleep there, without having to go through an elaborate waiting list process, please let me know. It's interesting and important to know. In any case, the Sunrise Cafe is under attack by 30 of the 44 neighbors have signed a petition. Those are the people whose homes or residences front the Circle area, and they have requested that the area around the Circle Church itself be declared a permit parking area. And the permit parking zone, as most of you local Santa Cruzans probably know, has been a rather nasty and somewhat concealed way, not that very well concealed, of criminalizing homeless people at night, or specifically their vehicles. So permit parking, you know, has some sense, both in the beach flats and up near the university, when tourists or students seize parking places during the day, which residents need for their own homes and families and so forth. And so what happens is these places have become permit parking, so you have to go and get a permit. You have to live there, or you can get a guest permit if you're visiting as a guest of one of the people who live there. And there's some rationale to that. But the strange part of all this is that at night, between the hours of some places it's 12 and 6, and some places it's 1 and 6, and some places it's, for a while it was 3 to 5 a.m. out at Harvey West. That was about a decade ago. You're not allowed to park your vehicle there without having a permit. And you can't get a permit unless you're a resident there or a guest. So it's a way of excluding people who are poor and homeless from parking their vehicles. And perhaps because of the protest-initiated change in the anti-homeless law, the sleeping ban, that happened in 2010, which says that if you are on a waiting list for either the River Street Mini Shelter or the Homeless Lack of Services Poly Loft, then tickets under the municipal codes, Thou Shalt Not Sleep After 11 O'Clock at Night, 6.36, will be dismissed prior to court. And that is a way for people who are sleeping in their vehicles or outside, if they're given those tickets, to not really ignore police. It's hard to ignore a police officer at 2 in the morning with a flashlight, badge, and a gun, and a get-moving command, dressed in fatigues or his usual police outfit, a truncheon at his side, demanding you move on, even if you're doing nothing other than sleeping, and move on to nowhere because he gives you no place to go, and probably move on even without a complaint, because police officers typically don't need a complaint to do that, and often don't have a complaint. Some officers apparently delight in doing it. Others, maybe you're trying to show they're tough in their neighborhoods. It's not clear if watch commanders are giving orders to the police to issue a certain quota of tickets. I've seen no evidence of that specifically in writing. But it will be hard to find if it's done verbally and if it's done with a mum's the word kind of quality. So I don't know. All we know is that when I went in to look at public records of citations, there were huge, thick packets of Municipal Code 6.36 citations for sleeping or for covering up with blankets or for covering up protective covering like a tent or a tarp at night. And actually the tarp and tent thing applies 24 hours a day. And there were literally more than 1,000 citations in the last year and a half. And actually, I got the records from the police department. It works out to about 4 citations a night. And you might say, well, what's that? You know, 4 citations a night. There's, 1 to 2,000 homeless out there sleeping. That's not very many. And it is true that that's only a small percentage of the homeless. But it also means that that homeless people are fundamentally in an insecure position. They can never feel safe. And that's particularly significant for women or for older people or for families who want to find some place to be safe. And it also means you're not safe from bigots who want to, on complaint, can arouse you and get you to move. And there's no safe place to move to. You don't know where to go. I know some would say, well, you know, if you get an old hand at this, you just keep a very low profile, you hide out. And for some people that works. I don't deny that. But in fact, for others, it does not. And that's particularly since a large portion of a homeless community is disabled in one way or another, that can be a significant addition to the burdens of being homeless. Not being able to sleep at night, of course, aside from being a form of torture, and aside from being unconstitutional, cruel, and unusual punishment, and aside from being a number of nasty things which citizens are not supposed to do to each other, and the government is not supposed to impose on its citizenry, of course, unless they're Islamic terrorists, then you can do what you want, I guess. But it hasn't really been claimed that the homeless people are terrorists, and no, I don't agree that they should. The government should be able to lock people up for more than a decade in behind a stockade if they have this terrorist label that they've decided they're going to attach to them. No, obviously, that betrays all the traditions that at least some of us felt were of value and that made this country, in spite of all its faults, gave us some hope. And that hope, of course, well, it tends to, as the late George Carlin said, fuck hope. In any case, the Circle's church is under attack through this permit parking process, which a number of neighbors out there want to exclude homeless people's vehicles there, which means people will not be able to park next to the church. Instead, they'll have to go park next to people's homes, kind of a strange approach, where there's not permit parking. And I don't think there's permit parking. Maybe there is. Maybe that's the rationale. I haven't. I'll have to go out there and check around. And maybe if anyone's listening to this broadcast and has been spending some time out in the Circle's Eretz Circle by the church out there, they can tell us whether there are posted permit parking signs around that neighborhood. Again, I doubt it. And that means people are going to have to park further away. They're going to have to risk further more confrontations with Take Back Santa Cruz-minded people who want to remove homeless people from their area and from the city generally. That is something we want to fight. So a bunch of us went in to get the records, to read the petition, read the names and addresses and claims of the people who want to set up this permit parking. Already there have been people who are protesting it and have sent in letters of protest. Marlon and Tish, who were two of the public works workers we talked to yesterday, did let us review the records. And they were going to let us copy them because first they said, well, you have to get a Public Records Act request, and that usually means waiting and so forth. I said, look, you have the records available. They're up there public, so let's you know, we saw them. Now let's make a copy for us. So, well, it's okay, but for our benefit, go to the city clerk's office and file a Public Records Act request and bring it back here, and we'll give you the records. Well, yesterday we went down to the city clerk's office. She, Christina, very amiable and helpful assistant city clerk, I guess that's her position, did fill that out for us. We didn't have to do anything. We stated what we were looking for. And she said she offered to email it to us, so we didn't have to pay for copies at some extravagant 25 cents a page copy, which, of course, has nothing to do with the actual costs of copying. And that was very good. But when I got home that night, there was no email. And I fired off an email to Christina, and I said, what's going on? These are public records. Where are they? And she was working late. She didn't have to send me an email, but she did, to her credit, and said, well, you know, we learned that there's been a delay, and we'll get them to you tomorrow morning. Well, came this morning. The records hadn't arrived either. And we're not talking about records that you have to search out. We're talking about records that we saw yesterday in a manila folder. All they had to do was send them to the city clerk's office, scan them, and send them out by email, which is what they intended, or I was told they intended to do, and which we are entitled to. These are public records. Well, now we were told, no, these have to go through another process by going to another official. And it's easy to, you know, conjecture that what they're doing, which is trying perhaps to protect, essentially, I call them bigots, but those individuals who want to exclude vehicles from parking at night around the inner, around the church outside, even though it's not next to their houses, they have no specific complaints. They're just attempting to do that. And there was initially there was a concern we had that there would be, this could be done by short-circuiting the Public Works Commission, which is supposed to hold hearings on this stuff. All they need, apparently, if you get 67% of the signatures in an area and there are no objections, then permit parking goes in automatically. I may have that wrong, but that was the concern I had. Well, I learned from the employees at the Public Works Department yesterday that whether that's true or not, it's not too clear to me. I either didn't ask or didn't get a clear answer. I'm not sure which, probably the former. But there was at least one letter in opposition, a rather strong letter opposing this, and there were 6 phone calls in opposition to this. And that requires the whole issue to go before the Public Works Commission. So it is not going to be an automatic veto on and criminalization of homeless vehicles. And it's very significant when homeless vehicles are criminalized. Because it doesn't just mean that they get tickets and that. It means that their homes can be towed away after they get 3 citations and can't pay them. And for homeless people, it is hard, for many homeless people, it is hard to pay these kinds of citations. It's expensive. It can be difficult even getting the notice. If you get a phony citation or a citation that needs to be contested and you don't contest it, you know, and don't get notice of contesting it at the time you need to, you can find yourself in a lot of trouble. And in fact, I think I recounted the case of one woman who had her vehicle towed, her pet impounded, her driver's license suspended, because the highway patrol decided they would come in and accuse her of being driving while drunk when she was parked waiting for the church to open. And again, it would be very interesting to see who called the highway patrol when the call was put through, because the woman in question tells us that there was not the case at all. She's been to a couple of Huff meetings, and she's also said that at a recent court appearance, now she's accused of having been driving on a Morrissey, which is all the way across town while drunk, where she said it was completely fabricated. In any case, sounds like there is a phone call that was coming in, but then suddenly disappeared. So, caller, if you want to call in, please do call again, 427-3772, and we will we'll talk. So, apparently there will be a Public Works Commission hearing on this issue. At least it'll be on their regular hearing schedule, whenever that is. I haven't checked that out yet. But the strange thing to me still is, and checking my emails, and I'll again check because I don't want to be unfairly critical of the city's records people, but I got to tell you, there's no emails from the city. So it looks to me like they're holding up on this information, which makes no sense except that they don't want us to have it. I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's hard to fathom their motivation, but I'll tell you more when I know more. But I encourage you to contact the Public Works Department, send them a letter. Anybody in the city can do it, suggesting they do not want this permit parking expanded, that in a city that makes it a crime to sleep in your vehicle and makes it so difficult to be homeless at all, this is an additional burden on people that is not justified. These areas that they're going to declare you can't park your vehicle at night without a permit are not areas where residents park their vehicles. They are, as I understand it, they're areas around the church. Another sad thing is that the church itself, because of its fear of being, further harassed by the neighborhood, is beginning to sort of draw back, as I understand it, from supporting homeless people. They're still doing the Sunrise Cafe, but the people who are doing it are getting, what would you call it, battle-weary in this situation. This is going to come up tomorrow, I guess, to some extent for some of us at this meeting of the an all-faith church group. Let's see what the exact name of this is so I don't mislead you as to what exactly is happening tomorrow. Let's take a look here. It is All Faith Community Conference on Social Justice, 2 to 7, Friday the 5th of September, that's tomorrow, at the Red Church. And that is open to the public. And in fact, Huffsters were quite enthusiastic about going to it and suggesting, again, a plan for 1,000 homes, simple homes. Actually, the phrase is simple houses, simple housing, so that we stop dicking around with camping and sleeping bins, and you need porta potties in this part of town. And actually, have areas where we do need porta potties and we do need camping areas. But this was an idea for simple housing: a roof, a place, a bathroom, a place to sleep, and that's pretty much it. I think there's a fourth thing, but we're not talking about any kind of Cadillac stuff. We're not talking about subsidized housing in the sense of having social workers running around to make sure you know how to write a check, or you don't go pee in your pants, or you don't smoke the wrong kind of intoxicant or drink the wrong kind of thing, but housing for people who need to be housed. And the community needs them to be housed, too. Let's not kid around. The expense of having people outside on emergency services, as groups like Smart Solutions and 180-180 have pointed out, is prohibitive. It's ridiculous. But, of course, these groups are simply, they claim, or at least critics claim, bumping people with Section 8 who've been on there for quite a while off on behalf of other folks who are more of an annoyance and a pain to businesses and the police and other groups that want to see them off the streets, and realize they can't just keep arresting them because they keep going back on the streets, because they can't. They're really just arresting them for quality of life, so-called quality of life crimes, which have to do with their disabilities often. And so they want, and these people should have housing, and they should have a place to go, but not at the expense of people who've been waiting for years to get into housing with Section 8. Not because, the tourist seeking merchant community, or the adulation seeking police department and the DA's office want to show how tough they are on the homeless, and yet how compassionate they are by removing really visible homeless people and saying, see, we removed the visible homeless, so aren't we great? Well, in fact, families are still outside, aren't getting any services in terms of what they need there in terms of housing. So tomorrow at the Red Church, from 2 to 7, actually Huff will be there at 1 to kind of pound out its statement. You can go down there and check them out and come on and talk to us. There's going to be this social justice discussion, conference on social justice. Or wouldn't it be a nice thing? So I'm now going to play a little music. Let's hear a little more from How to Succeed in Congress Without Really Lying from the Capitol Steps. And then hopefully we'll be able to get poet Julia Vinograd on the line and get poetic. And don't go away. Looks like we're having a slight technical problem, which is really very slight, and we're going to go directly into this. But apparently someone unplugged some wires that they shouldn't have done, and or I should have been more careful in noticing the wires that were unplugged. Let's see if we can roll with this.
Well, we members of the Tea Party are sick of how we got pushed around now. If we increase the debt ceiling in red ink, we're going to drown now. So we try
tried to make a deal and then you saw us shut the government down now.
Down, down, government
and
down.
And we'll
defund, fund, fund,
till Obamacare is taken away.
Defund, fund, till Obamacare is taken away.
We were blackmailing D.C. with our brand of populist insurrection.
Rection, populist wreck.
If Obamacare helps poor people, that interferes with natural selection.
Election, natural elect.
But we're cheered by Democrats across the aisle who have midterm elections.
Sections, midterm elections.
And we'll have
fun, fun, fun,
putting slogans on our T-shirts today.
Fun, 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 putting slogans on our T-shirts.
Wee-boo.
Are we just my babies? We're gonna find out.
So we're gonna fight against a bigger government. Yes, that is our mission.
Mission, that is our mission.
Health insurance that's affordable to millions needs our strong opposition.
Position, strong opposition.
In the Tea Party, stupidity is called a pre-existing condition.
Existing condition.
And we'll see.
Fun, fun, fun.
As we tell the same old story.
Shun, shun, shun.
Big government for glory.
Fun, fun, fun.
Till we shut down the whole U.S. of A.
Looks like,
and now, a word from New Jersey Governor Chris Christie.
Hey, how y'all doing? Okay, so you know, recently I got myself into a little bit of trouble there, scandal-wise, and yada, yada, yada. Forget about it, all right? You know, people have asked me, you know, is this going to affect my plans to run for president? You know, I don't know. I haven't decided. I figure I'll close that bridge when I get to it. You know, the worst thing about this whole thing is that a lot of people seem to think now that I'm really crass, you know, really kind of pushy, and really kind of gross. But, you know, I'll address those issues right after I get done telling this hot chick in the front row how good she looks. Hey, baby, your booty is so nice it should be called Chris Christie. Because it can stop traffic. But I'm bigger than that, all right? You know, back to me, okay? You know, this is why I would make such a good president, okay? Because I wouldn't take no guff, you know what I mean? Like, say some foreign leader got all up in my grill, give me a bunch of grief. Like the Queen of England giving me a bunch of lip. Here's how I'd handle that. London Bridge is shutting down. Shutting down. Shutting down. London Bridge is shutting down. Here. Traffic study. Like I once did in Fort Lee. In Fort Lee. Did you see? Roads were like my arteries. Clogged and nasty. I got one more verse, so shut up, okay? Now if commuters start to whine, just cause I'm showing some spine, they can read between the lines. It's New Jersey. Hey, I got a new movie coming out called Fat and Furious. Check it out. I'll see you later, okay?
And that was a couple of cuts from Capital Steps' latest album, Defund, Fund, Fund, and London Bridge is Shutting Down. Last one, of course, about the New Jersey Gov, who was punishing... I guess a municipality, or I'm not sure, was it a union, by shutting down bridges through phony traffic studies, or at least a particular bridge, which backfired on him. But we have finally online, or I should say quite right on time online, Julia Vinograd from Berkeley. Hi, Julia.
Hi.
And how you doing up there?
Oh, well... my last book was called Night, and I'm working on a new one, which is a new and selected work that ought to be out middle of October. It's called Cannibal Cafe.
You've done some cannibal books before, right?
Yes, that's usually what I call my selected works. The first one was Berkeley Street Cannibals, and then there was Cannibal Consciousness, and then there was Cannibal Casserole, and now it's going to be Cannibal Cafe.
Wow. And these are a series of poems from the last 40 years or more recent?
I think it's the last 8 books. It's not everything collected. That'd be too thick to carry.
Now, is your work available anywhere online? Can anybody actually read a few of your poems to get the flavor of it so they can decide if they want to invest $5? You've got pretty cheap books. It used to be a dollar, now they're $5, but then
yes,
time.
Yes, they are. Yeah. You can check Zeitgeist. They're my publisher. I don't know where else.
Maybe we should try to post a few of your poems on the Huff website. Maybe you.
Fine by me.
I think I may try to do that, make a note of it. So, you have some new poetry you've written that you may want to read?
Sure.
Well, fire away.
Okay, this one's called Street Teenagers. They grew up like dandelions through the cracks in stone, lovely, young, sworn at. The skin of their throats clear enough to almost show two-buck chuck wine going down. Cops try and move them along, remembering their 45-year-old wives nagging in the same meatloaf to the end of time. Street teenagers with false IDs and the pink nose of a twitching white rat making a third nipple between breasts. False IDs and true stories they don't tell, stories they... trying to forget or at least change to have happened to someone else. They live in a desert mirage where peaceful animals come to drink, and they wear locks and chains around their throats against anything else. Light faded blue jeans. Sometimes a wooden flute they haven't quite learned how to play.
And these are people you see from a distance or have conversations with?
A little bit of both. You know, I'll be sitting in the coffee house and looking at the kids outside.
Mm-hmm. Do you see much difference from when you were, there 10, 20, 30, 40 years ago up on Telegraph Avenue?
Yes, everything's more expensive.
What about the people?
The cops hassle people a lot more. It used to be a lot more easygoing.
Mm-hmm.
But, kids are still basically just kids.
Mm-hmm. How about the relationship between kids and the Med Cafe where you're often sipping coffee?
Yeah. Well, I like it when they have chairs outside so I can see whoever is hanging out, but they don't always.
In fact, I've heard from Michael Delacour, who was on the air about a month ago, that. There was some windows broken at the cafe.
Yes, they are. I don't know who did it.
Uh-huh.
They haven't been replaced yet, and I think the owner is trying to sell.
Oh, really? Wants to hit the road. Is this a long-time owner up there on Telegraph?
No. He's semi-short time, actually, but maybe he's getting tired of it or whatnot. I just hope it stays, a friendly cafe instead of turning into some chain piece of nonsense.
Now, this is a spot where you sell your latest book from. You
yes,
usually have
and
copies.
I need to be able to sell books.
And have you had problems selling books in other places? Have they told you, no, we don't like you selling your books and that sort of thing?
Very few places let me sell books.
Really?
Really.
An example of places that have refused you the right to sell books after you purchased a cup of coffee would be so that we know which ones not to patronize?
I wasn't allowed to sell books in the intermezzo, but it burned down. I didn't do it. Not my kind of thing.
I see.
And quite a lot of coffee houses.
So the Med is still kind of I know that, actually, it's interesting. I know that some people were kind of angry at the Med for some... There's a political dispute around how the police are treating people up at People's Park and on Telegraph Avenue.
Yes.
And the Telegraph Business Association has been instrumental in, I guess, making the climate more difficult for folks who are on the streets.
The business people don't like the street people, never have.
Mm-hmm. And
they can't quite handle the competition. A lot of the tourists would rather have their picture taken with the street people and hang out with them than go into a shop that doesn't look quite as interesting.
It's probably more overpriced. You know, Telegraph Avenue is unusual in that it's you can find people selling stuff on the streets who are street merchants. They're not just adjuncts to the stores that are right next to them.
Well, I like that.
And that's been the case for, what, 40 or 50 years now, right?
Yes.
And it's have you seen that in any other town?
I don't think so.
I haven't.
Sometimes at festivals, you know, like Deadhead festivals and whatnot, there'll be vendors around them. But,
Yeah, I mean, there are street fairs in San Francisco and elsewhere. And then Santa Cruz, they will close off the streets for the antique fair. And a few people who now are required to have business licenses prominently displayed so they don't get harassed by our own Officer Barnett down here do sell, you know, wraps and jewelry on the streets of Pacific Avenue in downtown Santa Cruz.
I like it more when it's spontaneous and homemade and everything.
Yeah, I mean, also
some of the vendors in Berkeley around the holidays, I can trade books for things. Nothing expensive, you know, seconds and smalls. A lot of them know me, and I do trades. Get a lot of my presents that way.
You are actually a person who lives on a very slim income.
SSI. And I sell books, which helps.
And your apartment is rent controlled?
Yes, but I wouldn't be able to stay in Berkeley.
And you yourself are somewhat disabled. Your mobility is limited.
Yes, that's how come the SSI. I had polio and I got a brace up to my knee.
Well, how about another poem while we're taking all this in here?
This one's called Suppose. Little old ladies go to the park, sit on a bench and feed the pigeons breadcrumbs, watching them peck and flap and butt heads for the biggest bits. Go to the lake and buy a bag to feed ducks. They spend hours watching them stretch their beaks or dive, squawking, splashing. It's a happy time. But suppose instead the little old ladies bought bags of cold meatballs, hard-boiled eggs, oranges, baby tomatoes, and chocolate chip cookies to feed the children. Not the ones having school lunches or safe at home, but street children, wild as pigeons, with grabby hands, frightened feet, and their only wings in their eyes. Not to help, but to relax, like feeding the ducks is relaxing. Sun on the water and nowhere important to go. And the street children look so funny, grabbing and gulping and licking cookie crumbs from their small, soft mouths.
Indeed. Give us another one.
Okay. Do you think that would work? I kind of like the idea.
Insofar as street kids are treated as animals, they're probably regarded more as pests than as cute, cute pets.
I was pushing for cute.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Occupy demonstration. I'd forgotten when I was a child I longed to walk on the white line down the middle of the street, and now I'm walking on it in a big chanting crowd with war-painted drummers leading us, and we're dangerously saving the world, expecting cops at any second, and walking on the white line is as sweet as candy. Our heads are about to fly into the sky like hot air balloons. We're walking into the sun, which can't burn us any more than the prophets in the fiery furnace. We're happy, righteous, and for the first time in my life, I can even sing on tune. The reporters always get it wrong. They only want to know if a rock broke a window, not if we broke water from a desert rock for all to drink.
I like it. How much involvement did you have with the Occupy movement when it was in Berkeley and going strong?
Not as much as I wanted to. I didn't like stay out all night and whatnot, but I was all for them, and I had a lot of friends who spent a lot of time, and I was at least all there in spirit.
Is there anything happening? I guess there's a concert coming up in People's Park shortly.
Yes, on the 13th, I think.
Yeah, I've been invited to come up and speak at the concert. I don't know if I'm going to get up there or not, but
that would be good.
Perhaps you'll go and read some poems. Are you planning to attend? Or?
Delacour told me to.
Well, Delacour says.
Yeah.
You think you'll be there?
I'm going to try. At least blow bubbles. Maybe read some poems.
So this is going to be this event. Do you know anything more about it? It's what is it a day-long event, and when does it?
I don't really know much about it. Can you hold on? I just got beeped.
Sure.
Hold on.
And we're talking with Julia Vinograd up in Berkeley. Her poetry is not yet available, or it wasn't when I was at the public library here in Santa Cruz, and they actually had declined to take her poetry and put it on the shelves because her books are all paperbacks, and I don't know why this would be the case, and I questioned it, but I have yet to press the issue again, and that's really my problem. Maybe I'll be able to do that shortly. I'll make another note to do it.
Hello?
Hey, welcome back, Julia.
It was a tape recording. I can't stand tape recordings.
Right. Well, we're better than a tape recording, although you are being recorded here, so watch out.
That's fine, but you're not a tape recording.
I sometimes feel like a tape recording, but no, I'm not. Not a tape recording. So you may be speaking. You're going to try to make it to the Saturday, September 13th.
Yeah.
That's a week from Saturday, I guess.
Coming right up, I guess.
People's Park, and that's right off of Telegraph, at Telegraph, and between Haste and, what is it, Bancroft? Not Bancroft, Dwight Way, right?
Yeah, between Haste and Dwight.
You want
to hear more poems?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I'm interspersing this a little, getting some of your, on-the-spot impressions. But go ahead.
This one actually happened.
Okay.
An 11-year-old revolutionary with purple hair. I was selling my poetry books at the crafts fair, and a lady came up to me with her daughter about 11, long purple hair, cute and shiny. The lady said she wanted one of my books but would have to go to the Bank of America to get money. She'd catch up with me. I didn't expect her to come back and didn't see her for an hour and a half. She was laughing. You know what happened, she said? My daughter protested, Mommy, we can't go to Bank of America. We have to go to a credit union. That's what all the Occupy people say. It took me a while to find a credit union, but here we are. I signed her book and smiled at the 11-year-old revolutionary with purple hair.
That's more of a prosody than a poetry, perhaps?
It happened.
It happened. Yeah, I had the same experience. I was using one of the major banks, and then I shifted to the Community Credit Union here in Santa Cruz in the middle of the Occupy movement. But I still wonder, where the Community Credit Union investments are going. I'm never quite getting enough information about what's happening. Give us another poem.
Okay. Big Mama Blues. Big Mama Blues. Swaying her heavy breasts like mission bells where hungry people wait in food lines. After their tinfoil-wrapped macaroni and cheese and an apple and a message to repent, Big Mama Blues opens her blouse and lifts her babies to suck love songs from her aching nipples. Day laborers reach wandering hands up into her tumbling hair. A saxophone perches on her bare shoulder like a pirate's parrot. A wild fiddle plays the straps of her low-cut dress. There's always a circle of drums under her red and gold spinning skirts. Baby, baby, sings Big Mama Blues, peeling the city's orange vests off tired construction workers like oranges fresh off a tree, peeling off soldiers' uniforms like onion skins over a wound. They're just her babies, after all, and they belong in her arms. Big Mama Blues, she knows all about it. She brings all the dead-end streets back to life. Cheap residential hotels and new tire lots catch fire from her torch songs. Big Mama Blues, she never looks back. She's danced with civilization, but only when she's in the mood. She's happier in a storm, lullabied by lightning overhead, instead of crystal chandeliers and her babies in her arms. Big Mama Blues were all her babies, after all.
Yeah, that's almost an erotic poem.
A little.
Yeah, have you got a special collection of erotic poems for those of us who wish to read your poetry in secret?
I don't know. There's a little bit of everything in my in my books.
Yeah, it's rare, though, that I find this really, you know, the strong erotic aspect, although there's, you know, there's certainly a sensuous aspect to everything you write. But, and a little kind of a teasy aspect, too. Give me another one.
Okay. Union picket line. Wind blows through the graveyards. First, it's sleepy, faded photographs of my dead family in bow ties and bustles joining the picket line to save the Union. Instead of a sign, Grandma B carries a doily-covered cake stand with a five-layer frosted chocolate cake to pass out slices rich as earth. The dead don't work anymore. Graves say rest in peace. My dead father's job was never in danger. He was a scientist. Companies fought over him. But there he is, wearing an armband and holding my dead mother with her black braids twisted up on her head. She glares wild wipeout at the cops like she glared at me when I broke a dish. My parents gave me a record of Pins and Needles, Songs of the Lady Undergarments Workers Union, the first union ever. Grandpa Ben and his golden retriever Wimby are there. I learned to stand by pulling myself up. Wimby's long hair, it must have hurt. Grandpa Ben was a doctor. If people hurt, he has to be there. My dead friend Vampire Mike got stuck on a welfare-to-work gig without a union, breaking up homeless encampments in the park. He called himself Victor Von Doom Police Gardener, and he hated it. There he is, singing dirty songs with a chorus of worms and winking at the girls. Wind blows through the graveyard. Each day there are more. Each night. If martial law is declared against the unions, they can only kill the living, not the dead. The dead won't go away.
I like it.
Mm-hmm.
Are these real people you're talking about in terms
yes.
of... These are your relatives.
The relatives are real. Vampire Mike was a friend. He's dead now, but he was real.
Huh.
And he really did get himself drafted in a welfare-to-work gig without a union.
Mm-hmm.
Nasty thing.
Huh. So you do regular poetry readings around Berkeley.
Some.
When are your next ones coming up?
I don't really know. Just the other night, a friend I knew was having a feature in Alameda, and we went to hear him. I read in the open, though I only got to read one poem. Everybody read one poem.
Hmm. So I guess you'll probably be reading at the People's Park on the 13th.
Hopefully.
On Saturday. And I think that it's probably an all-day event, but maybe I can get more information and pass it on to folks, you know, in the...
Ask Delacour. I think it's his baby.
Yeah. I heard he was trying to kind of do a fight-back kind of rally. He wants to fight back, as, you know, many of us do, if we have the right tools and the right allies. Got any more for us?
Let's see what else. Just called America.
Okay.
There was a knock on my door. I answered. It was America looking scared with its flags unrolling and blood clotting in its hair. Can I crash with you? Do you have a spare bed I can hide under? They're after me. How could you fit in my room? I asked. Aren't you the biggest, strongest country I heard about in high school? And who's after you? America was gasping, hands shaking too much to light a cigarette. It kept trying and grinding the dead matches under its heel like heads. Everybody. They used to want me so much. I bathed in their eyes each morning, but now they're coming with pitchforks and torches and the things they say. America tried to set its face into a quarter's firmness and failed. Have I been very bad? Well, yes, I told America, but I put up a junkie friend who just robbed a liquor store once, and I suppose you're the same thing on a larger scale. Some rules. Only one night. If you steal anything, you can't come back, and you can't scream in the night when you get the shakes or the cops will come. America staggered into my room and collapsed in a second-hand leather armchair, which creaked but held. In 2 seconds, America was asleep, breathing through its half-open mouth, its throat thrown back, hopefully not dreaming. The terror of the world, I shook my head, looking down at America for a moment, and then I went to put some coffee up to boil.
Wow, I like it. Is that an actual experience where you have had people up and told them that? Or?
No, I think that was just a poem.
Okay.
It's one of those things that should have happened.
I know that I used to do that when I was living in hotels. I would put people
up. You mean the other people crashing? Yeah.
Yeah.
It can happen.
You got more for us, or how are you getting tired up there?
Trying to find appropriate ones.
Mm-hmm. These are all poems that some of these have been published before, or these are all new?
Some of these have been published before, but they're going to be in the new and selected works.
Mm-hmm. A lot of your poetry appears in Street Spirit, or it was, at least it did, I don't know about recently. And I don't know if Street Spirit has an online website that people can go to, and I think some of your poetry may be there. They've had for the last year they've collected all the Street Spirit articles, which may include your poetry. I'm not sure. It's under thestreetspirit.org if people want to check out to see if your poetry is there. And also it's got some interesting stuff about social justice struggles in the East Bay and even a bit about Santa Cruz.
Trying to find some more that'll fit.
Mm-hmm. So we're listening to Julia Vinograd, who's up in Berkeley and is giving us a kind of a preview of her Cannibal Cafe book that'll be coming out this fall. This fall, actually. So yeah.
This is an odd one.
Go ahead.
Called Fiddle Strings. Each person swarming through the city is a fiddle string. God's fingers, brutal, gentle, pluck music from us. Vibrate us, mind and body. We do not stop at our skins. Music rises from us like steam rising from a sewer grating, a gutter rising past the moon. We can't hear our own music any more than we can see our own noses. We're stuck in a symphony of meanings wrenched out of us without our permissions. It can hurt. Music aches through us cold as a kiss to our very bones. We try to focus on the ordinary, impossibly as Jesus walking on water, but there is no ordinary. When we're in love, one person fills the world, but God's fiddle insists we're all like that all the time. We can't believe it. There isn't room. On the other hand, we weren't asked. Our music makes us larger and lighter than balloons in the Macy's Day Parade, and we always knew we could fly. It's just that we've forgotten. God's fingers take songs out of our mouths like a pickpocket. We don't even know we're singing. He lets us keep our privacy. We sing naked in our showers behind a plastic curtain with yellow ducks on it, and the rains come down. Our music is beautiful as we are. We can't hear ourselves. The city shines with our echoes, wet plastic yellow duckies. So beautiful.
Do you sing in the shower there, Julia?
I refuse to comment.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Got more time if you want to do it, or we can let you go, whatever you'd like.
Is any of your people interested in Burning Man?
Perhaps. I've always thought it's sort of upper middle class horse shit, but I don't know. You know, maybe it's...
Well, I've never gone, but I have a couple of friends who go all the time and come back raving about it.
Oh, well, then...
So I thought I'd write a poem, you know, see if I could go in my poem, though I certainly couldn't handle it myself.
Go for it.
Burning Man. I'm going to Burning Man. I'm not going to Burning Man. I'm bringing Burning Man to me. Machines embarrass me almost as much as flesh, but I close my eyes and push the buttons I make from make-believe till blue fire shoots from my fingers, and in that fire, walk false memories of true love. My own dry skull hangs like a ripe fruit on Burning Man's bone tree to be picked and eaten. I don't need a tent shelter from frying pan sand or high noon sun. I'm not really there. My nipples splash like Christmas tree lights around me, neon tubing cartoons of the Kama Sutra, Reinhardt bicycles at night, blowing kazoos or singing opera, toothpaste commercials. Amazing Grace! I'm bringing Burning Man to me. Fire is the belly button of the world. We were born from fire. A tribe of techno shamans, children playing with matches, lovers riding lightning in each other, skin flashing like a fireworks display. We burn the sky. Prometheus's groupies, then always some groupies for his vulture. The only proof I have that what they do isn't magic is they can't wait to tell me how it works. I don't understand and don't care. My Burning Man is magic because it's mine. The arms that aren't holding me hold on forever. I don't have to hoard supplies of bottled water. I can stop any time and fill a glass from the kitchen. I don't feel the stars' cold nails crucifying me all night through a sleeping bag with no protection from a wind off my own grave. Or do I? I'm bringing Burning Man to me. A Buddhist monk burns himself for justice. The giant wooden figure at the end of Burning Man burns for freedom. Until the two are one, all our words are ashes. The Buddhist monk dies in fire. The chanting crowd at Burning Man sets everything on fire looking for life. Holograms, grand pianos, towering carved condoms, sculptures made of hubcaps, grandfather clocks, and rubber dinosaurs. Life must be around here somewhere. We've all heard of it. Even I have heard of life. I'm bringing Burning Man to me. Laughing, weeping, almost spraining the mind's muscle, we use gold and red paint to paint a soul on our bodies. Druids use blue paint for pride in war, and at Burning Man, the war is with God. Sparks fly upwards. Will one spark catch in God's long white beard, just one? And before God blows us out like candles on a birthday cake, is there time to make a wish?
Indeed, is there time. I keep getting a beep, which indicates someone's trying to call you or call me, but I'd prefer to, you know, I'm happy to...
Do you
to
want to check them?
I wish I could. Our equipment here is, or I'm so primitive, one of the two, that it's hard for me to do that. But I'm looking at something. I brought along a collection of some articles that I've collected over the years, which feature you. One is from Street Spirit, March 1997. I don't know if you remember that. It's an interview by Terry Messman when you were doing your book Carnival Festival, I believe it was called.
It wasn't quite that, but you're close.
I can't quite read it. Cannibal Carnival, that's what
yeah.
it was. And after we're off the air, I'm going to read some of this stuff aloud. But it's got your poetry, but which you've read, and I'll leave that reading to you, although sometimes I do read your poetry.
Hmm.
But Messman has an analysis of your poetry, which is very favorable.
Well, that's sweet of it.
I haven't yet read a critical analysis. Do you have anybody who's ever written some nasty stuff about your poetry, or do you just ignore it if they don't like you?
I ran into a young kid in the med who said he'd be willing to edit my poetry if I wanted to. I said no.
Who thinks it needs editing, huh?
I don't know. He's a kid.
I like it, actually. You know, I mean, I think you come up with these images that are bright and fresh and, you know, profound and at the same time light. So I don't like everything, but...
No. I've got a short one on the Statue of Liberty. You want to hear that?
Yep. Yeah, sure.
The Statue of Liberty couldn't take it anymore. She shrugged off her shapeless green robes in disgust and made a band of sculptors carve shapely long legs in high heels taller than skyscrapers. She did a bump and grind, kicking over the stars, calling all sailors, moaning to be held, wanting ships between her steaming thighs. Pimps and politicians protested, so did postcard stands that sold her pictures. The Statue of Liberty was breaking her own promises by offering too much. She was breaking their rules. She wasn't tame. Her beauty wasn't selling anything. It simply rose like the sun. Wake up, she sang over America. Wake up.
The sooner the better.
It works for you?
I like parts of it. Yeah,
okay.
I do. I mean, and I like your endings.
Yeah.
You know, your endings are good. I don't know. Shall we give one or two last poems and then pass on? What do you think? You don't have to. If you
No, it's fine. I'm just trying to find something.
Okay.
That'll fit. This is called Money in the Bull Ring. The young goddess Money, her heart is cold as gold. She gives no quarter and gives no quarters to the homeless. When Money danced naked in the stock market bull ring, somersaulting between the horns of the bull, she faltered. The bull gored her soft belly and left Money bleeding. Banks, houses, credit cards, jobs, and the price of gas all in the dust, all down in the dust. Flashing lights circled Money's screams that stopped construction and student loans. Handlers roped Money, tied her to their horses, and dragged her writhing out of the ring, mud in her golden hair before the raging bull trampled her sweet young body. Money's cruel. Every man's felt the whip of her laughter on his back, the kick of her leather high-heeled boot on his butt. Everyone who loves her hates her, but sure can't live without her. When Money fell, used people went to use car lots and put for sales stickers on their foreheads. Ashes in shop windows fell apart at a touch. Computers made of ashes, dresses, toys, ashes. Money's in the hospital getting a transfusion. Envy, ambition, pride, and contempt forced into her veins. There's a plastic tube down her throat pumping countless zeros. The doctors, the spin doctors, never stop talking. Last night, Money's broken fingernail rose as the new moon. Money can't breathe until she's beautiful enough for us to reach for her and curse, spitting kisses into her face like before.
You got a last one for us?
Mm. What do I do for a last one? This is an odd one, but maybe. Called Dream. I dreamed of a department store selling wounds, some raised up by fluttering wings, some edged with delicate lace, some under spotlights backed by mirrors. It was an expensive store. Each wound came with a story. Immaculate shopmen carried rolled scrolls on silver platters to read the history of wounds in low, precise voices. The shoppers paused and asked their friends advice as if they were choosing diamond necklaces or ball gowns. Some of the wounds still bled. Some had healed scars that ached in winter. Veterans also shopped there, feeling their own wounds were out of fashion and wanting something better. Drinking fountains ran with bright red blood. Broken hearts dangled from chandeliers. Who'll take you seriously at a party without a broken heart? A large silver-green abalone shell full of glass eyes. Run them through your fingers. What do you see? There were no price tags. Each wound came at its own cost. You went on paying and paying. The store of wounds was always full. I dream nobody could live without one.
You know, I think you've written about wounds before, or maybe
I'm
I've heard
sure
that.
Sure I have, but not that. But that one's new.
That one's new. Okay. Well, thank you for all those new wounds. They aren't wounds. They're very nice. I don't feel wounded after those poems. We've been talking with Julia Vinograd, or listening to her, and my occasional interruptions, or my regular interruptions. Anything you want to add before we move on?
What's going on at Santa Cruz these days? How are you doing?
Twice weekly radio show, trying to squeeze information out of authorities. I was talking about that before I called you up. about equipment the police department is getting from the military, what kind of connections they have with
that. All that crap, yes.
You know, all the fun stuff. And how many times police are appearing on the streets in groups of three or more for, you know, serious incidents like a person sitting next to a building that they want to remove and mob. I'm trying to get some, you know, a real indication of how money is being spent in our police department's activities, and it's, you know, slow process. We'll see where it leads. A lot of it is done through simply, you know, pecking out stuff on the computer and asking the authorities for the right records. So not very exciting stuff. Nothing like the dreams you've been spinning here.
Well,
I appreciate your, you know, coming on at short notice. I called you earlier today. I will...
I hope you liked the poems. They're an odd assortment.
I did. You know, I mean, I'm... yeah, I did like your poetry. And it's rare that I don't. I usually do. And I'm glad you continue to write. And I will continue to invite you to come on the air and read and encourage people to buy your poetry, which they can get through what?
Either through Zeitgeist Press or just writing me, you know.
And give us your address.
My name's Julia Vinograd, Vinograd, and I live at 1630 University Avenue, number 34, Berkeley, California, 94703. And the books go for $5, but they cost a dollar extra to mail one.
Do you actually get much direct sales?
Sometimes. Anybody's interested, you know, just send me a check for however many you want, and I can send you different books.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have a lot of backups, and like I say, they're all $5, and you know, whatever.
And again, that's Julia Vinograd, 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 1630 University Avenue, number 34, Berkeley, 94703. And if you don't get that address, contact me on the Huff line at 423-HUFF, 423-4833, and I will get you her address, and you can actually send her some money so that perhaps she can have something more than a peanut butter sandwich for dinner.
Yes.
Thank you, Julia. Keep writing.
Thank you so much.
No, thank you.
Okay. Bye.
Bye-bye. And you're tuned to Free Radio, the stream of Free Radio, since we don't have a place to put up our antenna yet, but are still hoping that maybe we can get some help from all of you out there. Freakradio.org is what we're broadcasting on. If you want to find us, go there. And as you probably know, if you're there, you get online by clicking on the little red dot at the top of the antenna icon on that website, and not anywhere else. Don't click on click here, don't click on listen there on the website, but click only on the little red dot on top of the antenna. That'll put you onto the show, and the shows, not just mine, but all the rest of the shows here on Free Radio. Let's hear a little more from the Capitol Steps, then I'll be back with some interviews.
We now take you to a secret meeting between Senator Mitch McConnell and Senator Harry Reid.
Harry, things are bad. You shouldn't have used the nuclear option in the Senate.
But we were getting desperate. We were getting absolutely nothing done, and the American people were starting to notice.
And things are really bad. Congress's approval ratings are at an all-time low.
But have you noticed? Support for same-sex marriage is at an all-time high.
It's like the only way we're ever going to improve our approval ratings would be if we were to... Are you thinking what I'm thinking?
Oh, Mitch.
And now, the end is here. Folks have lost hope. Our polls are scary. Dear, I think it's clear we should elope and go get married. Our re-election chance we can enhance. That's why I say, since we're both guys, our polls will rise. Once you are my gay.
Oh, wow. This is just great. This clever switch that you are hatching. But now we must debate which one will pitch and who is catching.
I think I am the man, but that could change. As politicians, sex won't grow stale since we don't fail to switch positions. So this is our plan. It's worth a try to now be bipartisan guys. Don't filibuster our next kiss, 'cause with a crazy love like this, there's no debate, since we're both straight. It's really not gay.
And that was My Gay. Here's a little bit of Terry Messman, the editor of Street Spirits, analysis of Julia Vinograd before an interview that he did of her almost 20 years ago. But it still, I think, covers the tone and substance of her poetry. Julia Vinograd looks right at home amid the noise and bustle of Cafe Mediterranean on Telegraph Avenue in Berkeley, with its art-bedecked walls and the ghosts of a thousand caffeinated conversations about changing the world hovering in the air. The Med oozes atmosphere, as does Vinograd herself. But, of course... Oh, well. Caller, do call back. I give precedence to live calls, so if you call in, I'll talk to you, even if I'm in the middle of something, because... I can always repeat what I'm reading, but callers are sometimes hard to find. Continuing with this. Julia is adorned with eyeball rings and dressed all in black. She wears a poet button in her cap because when she takes her books from table to table, people think I'm a spare changer, so the button clears it up. The Med is a fitting place to interview Julia. It is one of her favorite haunts. Once, when it looked like the Med might close, she wrote a dreamy, melancholy poem, Some Morning, which began, I feel I'm about to lose my job, except I don't have a job. I feel they'll come some morning with a pink slip and take away my coffee and take away my table at the Cafe Med and take away the Med. And they'll tell me politely that, of course, it isn't personal, but they found someone else to polish the light who doesn't need to breathe as much as I do. Her poem casts light on the symbolic relationship between Julia Vinograd and Berkeley hallmarks, such as the Med, People's Park, Telegraph Avenue, and, of course, a striking cast of surreal characters and street people. Such a strong identity pulses between Julia and these Berkeley scenes that if they are threatened, Julia might herself disappear. Perhaps that is why she fights so passionately through her poetry to preserve People's Park, to uphold the rights of street people, and to save the fading images of vanished places and dead friends from the oblivion of time. She herself is indelibly part of a Berkeley landmark. Her black-clad image perennially blows bubbles on the People's Park mural just off Telegraph Avenue. Julia is a poet who chronicles and alchemically transforms the living history of Berkeley. Although she is a self-defined street poet, and many of her poems do contain moving accounts of the daily lives of people on the streets and vivid reminders of their humanity, in truth, Julia is far more than a chronicler of street life. Her poems cover the entire spectrum of human experience: love, memory, death, beauty, heartbreak, the joys of daily life, art, the blues, and poetic vistas of other times, other places. She is gifted with a sensitive poetic eye and a spirited dose of utopian longing. Despite her disavowal of garden variety politics, she has an eloquent political voice and a restless conscience that flares out when an outbreak of war or greed harms the defenseless. Vinaigrette also possesses a weirded-out sense of humor, a soaring imagination, and a feeling heart, all the better to love or weep over the strangely compelling menagerie that is Berkeley. Her poem for the Berkeley Inn goes beyond a remembrance of things past to celebrate and cherish the lives of low-income people who were her neighbors. Some people in an interesting, affluent Berkeley are perhaps glad to see the hotel gone along with the marginal folks who live there. But by poetically reconstructing that time and place, Julia defies the demolition, rebuilds the inn out of her imagination, and reminds us that in the midst of an uncaring society, its residents cared about one another. By honoring the lives of spare changers, street musicians, and homeless persons, Vinaigrette reclaims their worth and dignity at a time when the powers that be are intent on sweeping the Bay Area clear of those they consider undesirable. Perhaps the most important way that this poet of the streets practices her own form of deeply felt resistance to injustice is by simply reminding all of us that the people we pass on the street are worth caring about, worth cherishing, worth memorializing in heartfelt poetry. And that's the introduction to an interview of Julia Vinaigrette by Street Spirit editor Terry Messman, who is still editing after all these years, though I can't seem to get him to reply to my emails. He's a busy guy and not doing, his health is failing too, I understand. The poem that Julia wrote for the Berkeley Inn where I lived for 15 years being torn down, and I lived in the Berkeley Inn 2 years and years ago. It was on the corner of Haste and Telegraph up in Berkeley. It was a five-story building, sort of, I guess the rooms weren't plush. I guess they were kind of downscale, but they seemed plush to me at the time when I was there, and I was in my 20s. I think that's a long time ago. It eventually... someone set fire to it. Some said it was the owner to collect the insurance. And it's now in a fenced-off area at Haste and Telegraph, if you go up there. Here's her poem. The wrecking ball swinging against the bricks as big as Crazy George's shaved head when she took a heavy stick on full moon nights, banged on all the doors, and bellowed for quiet like a charging refrigerator. The cops always came when George had a quiet attack. Heavy shoulders, muscled neck. It took three of them to haul her off, and she was back the next morning. As the bricks tumble, she roars from the ruins, "Quiet! I said quiet, you assholes!" "It's going down," the watching crowd gasps. "With each blow, it can't be fixed anymore. Not even Charlie can fix it." Charlie, the desk clerk mechanic whose wife ran off with a cop, so he became a Stalinist, and the landlady fired him each time he got drunk. But she always hired him back, because the elevator was in love with him and wouldn't work for anyone else. He had a dozen TV sets in his room and that he took happily apart and put reluctantly back together, and he was kind to me. I look at the plaster dust. There should be records of that kindness, set in plaster like fossil leaves, but it's all gone now. And Florence, the first landlady, skinny, tough, always furious. We said she'd run a whorehouse in Texas, which is the highest compliment tenants can give a landlady. She told me that if I went out into some riot, she wasn't letting me back in. So I stalked out nobly, collapsed from the tear gas, and Florence ran after me and dragged me back, more or less, by my ear. I once saw her threaten to call the cops on a cop. As long as these walls stood, they knew her name. But one wall is down, and the second is going. Now I have to write her name, and she never did think much of poetry. And Guy, one of the oldest desk clerks, much too deaf to work, but he wouldn't believe it. Someone would come and ask for a room, and Guy would turn purple and yell, "You can't call me that," and reach for a nightstick under the desk, and whoever was backing him would take it gently away. Were we all crazy? Mainly we were friends. And with friends, it's not a pertinent question. And there was the building itself. There'd been a banquet room once, closed before I moved in. There was a TV room where we all came and tried to spot ourselves on the news. There were five floors of hot plates, pot plants, parties, people overnight, and never enough toilet paper. There were cockroaches, of course, but very clean cockroaches. I had a room with five walls and a view of the hills. I thought I would live there forever, and I thought I would live forever. A pile of rubble with pigeons circling, but when I close my eyes, I still see that rug in the lobby, red, maroon, blue-looped, swirling. Everyone swore it was the first rug on acid. And I see the switchboard behind the desk, a tangle of beeping lines, as the desk clerk snaps, "Hold on a sec, just hold on." And I'm holding. But it's hard. It's for the Berkeley Inn where I lived for 15 years being torn down. And that's in the 1997 issue of Street Spirit, a newspaper where you probably won't be able to find it anywhere, but we do have all the articles about Santa Cruz and by Santa Cruz authors that have been retrieved and posted on the Huff Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom website. And they can be found by going to huffsantacruz.org, www.huffsantacruz.org, and looking for Street Spirit. And I understand the old street shit sheet, for those of you who are really old-timers, like 20, 25 years old, though there were some issues of the street shit sheet that came out more recently, not that recently. This was a newsletter that I largely wrote, but also included pieces from other people about the struggle for homeless rights in Santa Cruz, mostly from 1988 through 1995, although it actually continued sporadically into about till 2007, 2008. And I've often toyed with the idea of putting out another issue, but I don't. Who knows, maybe I will at some point. In any case, you'll be able to view this for the first time if you're an old-timer and you want to look at it, or if you're a person who has a historical interest in homeless civil rights struggles and the perspective of at least one person, me, on what happened way back then. It's got a kind of a humorous side to it. You can go online to the Huff website, huffsantacruz.org, and you can read it. I don't know if it's been posted quite yet, but it should be up there soon. It was up there in jumbled form, and now it's going to be actually in readable form. So a tip of the hat to troublesome Thomas Levitt, an old-time activist, not as old as I am, though, who did the work on this and scanned it in, and presumably it's either posted or will be posted shortly. So, all that, and now time for a little street interviewing. And some of the events I get to, I record, and sometimes the recordings are not as good as other times, and I apologize for that. But there was an interesting event I attended, which was the kickoff party for City Council candidate Bruce Van Allen, who I'm regularly dissing at the Huff meetings where other activists are praising him as a relative liberal on the Santa Cruz scene. And indeed, Bruce has done some liberal things, or even recently, at least. And he's backed, he helped make buttons for, or provided the resources to make buttons for the Santa Cruz 11, I understand. Tip of the hat to you, Bruce, for that. Santa Cruz 11, the people falsely charged with actually just politically harassed for being members of an Occupy movement that filed through an occupied building and supported the occupation of that building, the vacant Wells Fargo Bank leased 75 River Street building. Now their trial, which will be costing another $150,000, has been delayed, the final four of the Santa Cruz 11, until July of 2015, when this continuing Damocles sword, this threat that hangs over activists. Never before in the history of Santa Cruz have we been charged with felonies for simply peaceful political protest. It is really a new and darker era, and that is sad and infuriating as well, and chilling. Anyway, Bruce Van Allen had a kind of a picnic political event where he announced his candidacy and his supporters came and rallied. This tape, unfortunately, kind of sounds a little like a roller coaster. It goes up and it goes down, and the volume varies, and I apologize for that. But some of the things Van Allen said, though it's really hard for me to credit politicians who talk during their election campaign, whatever they say, I tend to devalue it, and I look instead at what they have done and whether they have, in essence, sought the kind of goals that they have claimed that they're going to be putting into power, putting into practice through at least pressing for legislation. Let's hear some of it, and I'll be interjecting my caustic commentary and sometimes approving commentary. I have sent Bruce Van Allen, Laney Sherman, David Chirazes, three of the seven candidates running, questions to answer that I passed around the Huff meeting yesterday about a series of issues. And very quickly, those issues are... will you demand an end to the after-dark curfews in Santa Cruz? Will you support a moratorium on laws that punish sleeping outside or in vehicles at night, as proposed by the Santa Cruz American Civil Liberties Union, finally? Will you act to defend the few possessions homeless people have in their makeshift campsites at night and on their persons during the day from inappropriate seizures by police and parks and rec rangers? Will you restore the public space to the community by eliminating forbidden zones and move-along laws on the downtown streets? Will you help establish police priorities to focus on real crime instead of having them act as a quasi-military auxiliary with intense focus on crimes such as sitting, sleeping, and smoking? Will you support immediate renter protection, stabilization, and or rent control laws, as well as penalties for vacant property speculation here? Will you take time out of your day to document police overkill and support regular community street presence to stop Ferguson-style police barbarity here? Will you stand up for unpopular positions and be a whistleblower, even at the risk of alienating the established political economic powers and your fellow city council members? And so far, I haven't gotten any of the council members to respond to this, though in fact, only one was actually presented with these by email, Laney Sherman, and she's not responded except to state that she will give her answers in private and that she's made some general statements about being sympathetic to lower-income people. I probably should read exactly what she says, and I think I will at a future time. But the answer to the specific questions, she ignores the specific questions, or at least has not answered them. And that's what's significant to me. I want to see some straight answers on some hard questions. Even if the answers are answers I don't like, I want people to be honest about what they're willing to do and what they're not willing to do, and not lead us along, do what they need to say to get elected among a liberal constituency and then do what is usually done after elections. Move to the right, which is what almost invariably has happened, at least on the issues I've been concerned with. So let's hear some interviews, or actually this is Bruce Van Allen speaking at his rally 2 weeks ago, more or less, maybe 3 weeks ago, in Harvey West Park.
Being at this location has a special resonance for me. Some of you might know, in one of my last acts as mayor 32 years ago, I dedicated this part of Harvey West Park, the Friendship Garden. This part of the park was a cooperative project of the Seroptimists and the city. And as I think you know, and it should be obvious, it's meant to be fully accessible, including not just for wheelchairs, but in things like fragrant plants that you can smell and enjoy even if you're blind and things like that.
Of course, it's not accessible to homeless and poor people at night. And the Harvey West Tenants Association has made that clear, as well as the Parks and Rec Rangers and the Santa Cruz Police Department. And You don't hear Bruce mentioning that about the Harvey West Park at night, even though maybe he's just not aware of it. It's kind of ironic that he talks about how accessible it is when to poor people at night it's not accessible at all. No parks in Santa Cruz are open at night. Even areas that aren't parks but were designated parks in order to criminalize being there at night, such as the area at the town clock, are there now forbidden zones at night.
I have to say, I cried when I dedicated it because it was such a special thing for Santa Cruz to do, and it gets me going again because this is a really special town, and we really do care about making sure that everybody is part of the community and recognized, and their needs and their aspirations are included in what city government does. And that's why I want to get back on the city council.
And there's the issue for me is whether, what has Bruce done in the last 20 years? What has he supported publicly? When people were trying to end the sleeping ban by initiative in the 90s or push for a lawsuit 10 or 15 years ago to end the sleeping ban by a judicial ruling, or supported the safe zones at city council when they were actually passed on a first reading and then at midnight tabled and dumped after protests from that very Harvey West area. And other areas of Santa Cruz that where right-wingers mobilized support against, particularly the police department, against the safe zones, which weren't that safe, actually, but they were a beginning in trying to establish legal places for homeless people to go. I don't know. I really have yet to hear Bruce's activities in any of that. The rhetoric is nice, but what about the substance? And I remain open. If other people have information about this, I'd like to know about it.
Trying to move that kind of thing forward. Now, I thought about what to say to those. So, enjoy this park if you haven't been here before. I thought about what I wanted to say today, and this may end up being shorter than the introductions. I set aside the three-hour Castro-style speech for another occasion.
Election.
And so what I want to do is sort of pantomime the three central themes, and I had a chance to rehearse this at the Solidarity Rally earlier today at the Town Clock, Solidarity with People in Missouri.
And it was about this time that I actually stopped taping because it sounded like he was going to do the same canned speech that he did at the Town Clock. But as I left, he began talking about issues I'm concerned about, so I had to stop and go back, and you'll hear this. There's a gap between, I didn't catch his pantomiming was one opposed desal, another don't shoot, hands up, don't shoot. And there was a third pantomime gesture that I don't remember he was trying to, he used as a sort of a frontispiece or a main presentation, a kind of a, that demonstrated what he claimed he wanted to put across at council if he was elected.
This is why I'm glad you all found places to sit. Anti-consumption. I apply this not only to the terrible things that have happened in Ferguson, Missouri, but all over the country, including if you're a person of color, especially a young man, if you're a homeless person, if you're an immigrant, especially from Latin America, if you're poor, if you don't dress right in some neighborhoods, you risk that same hands up don't shoot dilemma. Certainly it's a more severe question for someone who's African American and someone, many people who are from Latin America or other. But this is actually something that hurts all of us. And the idea that militarized police forces, and some of that same Pentagon footballs has come locally here, the idea that that's good and that that solves social problems and that that is a way to address poverty and racism and cities that really don't work for all their residents, or cities that are controlled by a narrow clique and not representative of the population that they live in. No, that's un-American. That's wrong. We should fight that. And here in Santa Cruz, there's an aspect of that atmosphere. I just realized there's people here. There's an aspect of that atmosphere, which is that there are people who are afraid in their neighborhoods. and I honor that fear, but I reject, and we should reject too, when the way that fear is responded to is with the way that fear is scapegoating of immigrants, scapegoating of homeless people, This goes right along with attacks on LGBT people. It goes right along with the approach that our country was founded to get rid of, which is the use of power against the people, the use of institutional power, the use of armed power. And we need to stand up. We need to recognize that law enforcement, who in Santa Cruz have heard from the community many times, and many of them do the best they can, but there's an atmosphere that encourages them, that stokes them to mistreat people and to attack people fairly. To neighborhoods, to parents who teach their kids that it's okay to attack homeless people, BB guns at them or beat them up while they're sleeping. This is unacceptable. And so part of why I'm running is to fight back and speak out against that.
All right.
I will probably be attacked. Speaking out. So I need you with me for this. This is going to be a hard race.
Yeah. I'll get him, Bruce.
The capture speech is in my pocket. So let me just go through that again.
And I apologize for the quality of that recording, but I think you catch the gist of it. He doesn't, of course, he does criticize the police department, which is a sacred cow in Santa Cruz, particularly after the endless adulation for, you know, the shooting deaths of Officer Sticky Fingers, Lauren Butchie Baker, and Elizabeth Butler, what was it, year before last or last year. And all the, you know, support your local police signs up and down Pacific Avenue, not so much now as there were last year. But it takes a certain amount of courage to speak out about these issues, less when you have this Ferguson scandal blossoming. And that's one of the really positive things that's come out of this Ferguson shooting of Michael Brown, is that angry people across the country are now speaking up about what's happening in their neighborhoods where police are shooting people dead. And in Santa Cruz, this is also a consideration, too. Although we haven't had anybody shot dead, we've lost people in the jails through inadequate medical treatment, and then in the grand jury has even commented on that. But I'm going to actually read something more about Ferguson, because there's some, it's not so much in the news, although the protests are continuing, I understand. And I'm glad to hear that. But the there's some interesting background to this, as well as some stuff that's happened in other cities, which compares interestingly with Ferguson. So, for instance, here's some stuff that I got from an article from Al Jazeera, America Al Jazeera, on the history of segregation in St. Louis, of which Ferguson is really sort of a suburb in St. Louis. Ferguson, tucked into the North County, is one of those tiny cities with a population of roughly 21,000, a population that has shifted from about 25% black to two-thirds black in just two decades. Today's rules are about curfews, sagging pants, and evening protests. In the late 1770s, Spanish colonial ordinances restricted slaves from holding nocturnal assemblies, dressing in barbarous fashion, quote-unquote, and leaving their cabins. So it was curfews, sagging pants, and evening protests even back then. In essence, these laws are slave laws. In February 1915, a letter went out to white homeowners. Dear neighbor, do you realize at any time you are liable to suffer an irreparable loss due to the coming of Negroes into the block in which you live or in which you own property? A group of St. Louisians wanted to use the reform provision in the city's newly revised charter to enforce racial segregation. Despite opposition from the mayor and vocal politicians and church leaders, St. Louisians voted 3-1 to prevent blacks from moving into any neighborhood that was already 75% white or vice versa. In 1916, St. Louis became the first city in the nation to pass a segregation ordinance by referendum. This according to the America Al Jazeera paper. A 1917 U.S. Supreme Court decision made that ordinance illegal, so white St. Louis homeowners began using racial covenants, securing promises from all neighborhood residents never to sell to a black person. In 1948, the Supreme Court made the racial covenants illegal. So suburbs quickly put exclusive zoning restrictions into place, requiring large single-family lots. Banks made mortgage policies accordingly. Developers learned about blockbusting, and real estate agents learned to steer their clients' flight from the city. John Wright, former assistant superintendent of the Ferguson-Florissant School District, remembers a chain stretched across a road to cut off access from the black city of Kinloch to then-white Ferguson. Wright is now retired and is a cultural ambassador to Senegal. "I tell people I grew up in an apartheid town," he said. "The only two places I remember being able to go were the public library and the St. Louis Zoo. Everything else was determined by where you lived and your skin color." In reaction, St. Louis has spent enormous sums of public money to spatially reinforce human segregation patterns, Allen said. "We tore out the core of the city around downtown, just north and south and west, and fortified downtown as an island by removing so-called slum neighborhoods. Then we demolished vacant housing in the Ville, where rocker Chuck Berry and opera singer Grace Bumbry grew up, and other historic black neighborhoods. These were not accidents. These were inflicted wounds." Many black residents wound up renting, moving often, and never acquiring home equity or savings to bequeath to their children. The areas where they lived had no tax base, inadequate schools, and no appeal to local businesses that could have provided jobs. Black communities in urban areas don't have Whole Foods, they don't have a Starbucks, they don't have work, said Gerald Early, director of the African American Studies at Washington University. And that goes back to legalized segregation. They were basically set up to not be able to compete with white communities, to remind people every day that they were inferior to whites. St. Louis might look inclusive. The city has had two African American mayors, and the county has had an African American chief executive. But electoral politics promised more than it ultimately delivered, because power is diffuse, Early said. It's in the economic realm, it's in the cultural realm, and in those areas in St. Louis, black people have very little power and very little influence. They have very little presence. In 1980, more than 4,000 people lived in Kinloch. Today, there are not even 300, and the entire municipality has been reduced to less than 1 square mile of land, drained of most of its tax base. Kinloch is a neighboring community to Ferguson. What used to be streets lined with houses, churches, and corner stores now resembles an undeveloped plot of land sprinkled with decaying buildings and cracked, empty streets. Much of the land belongs to the city of St. Louis. Nearly the entire town was torn down to accommodate a runway that in the end was never built. The ground shakes when landing planes pass over it, an ironic homage to the fact that the city's first airstrip was in Kinloch, a point of pride for many of its former residents. And here's a story about Rio. From Ferguson to Rio, two black teenagers shot dead by police, two very different reactions. Michael Brown's death in Ferguson, Missouri, triggered nights of violent protests, criticism of police tactics, and racial upheaval. But in Rio, Brazil's second largest city, 15-year-old Lucas Lima was another statistic. A black teenager gunned down by police, a grieving family, a furious community, and then after a few days of tears and anger, a story that fades from view, leaving only the private misery of a heartbroken mother and a bereaved brother searching for justice. The shooting of 15-year-old Lucas Lima in Rio de Janeiro bears similarities with the killing of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, but the response of the public and the authorities could hardly be more different. I don't know about that, but let's read more. Lucas Lima was 15 when he was shot dead by police in the Almayao favela in Rio in June this year. While Brown's death at the hands of the police in the U.S. sparked violent protests, international condemnation, and a nationwide debate about racism and violence, although we have yet to see any meaningful changes, even the police officer who shot him dead is still on the force and has not been charged with any crime. Officer Wilson, I believe his name is. Few people outside the Almayao favela in Rio de Janeiro will have heard of Lima. The killing of the 15-year-old has made barely a ripple in Brazil's public consciousness, in part because it is all too common. Although Brazil has a population that is a third smaller than that of the U.S., it has almost five times as many killings by police. And though the vast majority of the victims are black or mixed race, there is far less of a debate about race. Lima was killed on the 22nd of June on his way home from a football game with his friends. It was not yet dark, but his was an extremely violent neighborhood. Dozens of residents and five police officers had been killed in Almayao, a bastion of Comando Vermelho's drug trafficking organization, and the nearby Penlia favela in the first 7 months of the year. One of those officers was shot hours earlier, making police more jumpy and trigger-happy than usual. According to his brother, Tiago, Lima was coming down one of the favela's many steep roads when he encountered police who were chasing after a group of local youths. Seconds later, he was lying lifeless on the street along with another young victim. Police reported finding a gun between them. Who it belonged to is unclear. Tiago believes it was put there by police to cover up their mistake. This happens all the time. Every day there are shootings and killings by police, said Tiago. Almost all of those who are killed are mixed-race young men from the favelas. The police are ill-prepared. They don't come thinking there are good people here as well as criminals. They just want to do a job and, excuse my language, fuck everyone else. The local community protested briefly, but compared to Ferguson, the reaction was muted. While Brown's death in the U.S. prompted criticism of police racism and a militarized law enforcement apparatus that has killed more Americans in the past decade than the war in Iraq, the death of Lima was only briefly covered in the Brazilian media. Even in his neighborhood, many felt powerless to do anything. Police in Ferguson arrest a demonstrator protesting the killing of teenager Michael Brown. There's a picture of that. There are many injustices, but we are afraid of the police, too afraid of the police to stand up to them. That's why nothing changes. Even if you complain, nobody listens. It's too common. People think, oh, yeah, another death, and Tiago. Said Tiago, my brother is just a statistic. Based on official data, academics and NGOs estimate that about 2,000 people die at the hands or guns of law enforcement officers in Brazil each year. The comparative figures in the U.S. is about 400, compared with 2,000 in Brazil. In 2013, the number in the U.K. and Japan was zero. Ferguson is a daily occurrence in Brazil, noted Ignacio Cano of Rio de Janeiro State University, whose studies have shown that blacks in Rio are three times more likely to be wounded or killed by police than would be expected by their share in the population. This may be a conservative estimate. Cano said the problem is grossly underreported by the authorities. The Brazilian state doesn't take these police shootings seriously. If it did, we'd have good data on it. Francergio Goulart, a black activist who recently produced a map of killings in Rio, said his research showed that homicides among whites fell in the past 10 years, while the rate increased in the black and mixed-race communities. We have numbers that equate to a war, Goulart said. The central issue is that these homicides, is institutional racism, he said. The war on drugs, in reality, is a war on poor and black people. The state is killing young black males. Goulart helped to organize a recent demonstration against the genocide of black people, but it attracted nothing like the same level of participants or media attention as the protests in Ferguson. Last Friday, rallies took place in 18 cities, but the biggest drew less than 400 in Rio and 1,000 in Sao Paulo. Police spokesmen say the high number of shootings by police reflects the violence of a society in which more people are murdered than any other country in the world, and where officers often die in the line of duty. They also note major improvements in some cities. In Rio, which has the most killings by officers, there are now about a third of the cases of a decade ago. Most are classified as having taken place when the victims were, quote, resisting arrest. Video evidence often disproves this. In June, a dash cam on a police car caught police officers chatting about hitting the target after two teenagers who had been in their custody were left dead on the road. Two less, one says. If we did this every week, it could start declining. In March, passersby filmed a police car dragging a woman along a street after the officers had injured her in a shootout and thrown her in the boot. Mother of four, Claudia da Silva Ferrara, died soon afterwards in a hospital. Protests are usually localized, short-term, and make little impact. In May, residents in Manguijos took to the streets after a 19-year-old Jonathan de Oliveira Lima was shot in the back by police. In April, demonstrators erected blazing barricades in Copacabana after the body of dancer Rafael da Silva Pereira was found in a school during a police operation in the Pavao Pazazinho favela. While the killings far outnumber those in the U.S., the reaction of a white-dominated media has, for the most part, been more resigned than angry. If every death of a young black man by police in Brazil prompted segments of the population to fill the streets, as in Ferguson, but Ferguson is the only place, seemingly, or one of the very few places where that actually happens in the U.S., we would live in a state of daily seizures, opined columnist Luiz Fernando Viana, in a Folha de São Paulo article headlined, Ferguson is Here. And that's a story from The Guardian. From Ferguson to Rio, two black teenagers shot dead by police, two very different reactions. On September 1st, President Obama formally notified Congress of the beginning of airstrikes against the Iraqi town of Amerli, as required under the War Powers Act. Administration officials say the attack was, quote, consistent with military missions we have outlined to date in Iraq. Under the War Powers Act, the president, is allowed only to launch such unapproved operations in the case of, quote, a national emergency, which would be a difficult case to make in Iraq, and also he can only continue the war for 60 days without a congressional authorization for the use of military force. Start counting the days, folks, and see what Führer Obama does. The 60-day clock really should have been ticking from the start of airstrikes earlier in August, but could be argued to begin with the Amerli strikes, which are what the administration notified Congress about. Either way, continuing the war beyond 60 days would be a blatant